In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Friday, August 19th, 2011, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It is the Federal News Countdown, as we do every Friday at 3, and the experts choosing the stories in our countdown this week are a couple of my my good friends on the countdown. Deborah Roth, a multiple-time guest on the show, partner at Shaw, Bransford & Roth, and one of the co-hosts of Fed Talk every Friday at 11 on Federal News Radio. Now, the challenge for you, Deborah, it's great to see you, first
Thank
of all.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Happy to do it. The challenge for you whenever you're on the show is that since you do a radio show all the time, you have to be excellent every time.
Right. Well, it's also not to act like the host.
Well, that's true, because that's what you're used to doing when you're in this room.
It's take a back seat.
Is hosting the show. But you always are excellent.
Thank
I'm glad
you.
To see
Thank you.
David Olive is principal at Catalyst Partners and is my other expert on the countdown this week. Dave, it's great to see you. Happy summer.
Great to be back. Happy Friday.
Thank you very much. Before we get started with your stories, I wonder if you are sensing the same thing that I'm sensing, that normally we're in this time of year, we're in the dog days of August. And yet, this year, it doesn't seem like that's the case at all. There's a lot of stuff going on. You guys have great stories in the countdown. But there's the budget stuff. There's the all of the things that we'll talk about today. And people still in the federal government queasy about what the deficit commission might do and how that might affect pay and benefits. It just seems like there's an awful lot going on. So I'm happy that you're here. And, of course, we're ready to start with
number three.
The third most important federal news story of the week, according to Deborah Roth, is from the New York Times. The headline is U.S. and allies say Syria leader must step down. This is really surprising that after a long period of time, the president and the State Department not saying anything about what's going on in Syria. That's their business. They should do themselves. Now this week, the president and Secretary Clinton both saying change is due immediately.
Yeah. And, you know, what I thought was interesting about the story, and I was talking with David before we got on the show, was that, you know, it's such a strong contrast to sort of, you know, what we refer to as the Arab Spring. I mean, when you think about another really longtime partner of the United States, Mubarak, you know, in the decades and decades of partnership, how quickly our administration, our government said, you know, you need to go. It happened, and we saw it happen again with Libya. Mm-hmm. It didn't happen as quickly, and that's sort of behind the scenes. No one really knows why it didn't happen that quickly, but all of a sudden it happened, and really, what does it mean for everybody? What does it mean for the federal government? What does it mean for the federal workforce? What does it certainly mean for the taxpayer? What does it mean for the Middle East? And it just didn't play out like, you know, what happened in Egypt played out one way. What's happening in Libya is playing out another way. Mm-hmm. You know, where's this headed? It's an interesting third track.
Yeah, the New York Times story says the White House and the State Department debated the issue intensely in recent weeks, with Mrs. Clinton arguing that a call for Mr. Assad to go would be meaningless without broader support and action. An administration official said the president first broached calling for Mr. Assad's departure in a phone call with Mr. Sarkozy and Ms. Merkel on August 5th. And then the story also mentions earlier that just about the same time that President Obama made his statement, British Prime Minister David Cameron, President Sarkozy in France, and Chancellor Merkel in Germany saying the same thing. European Union, same thing. United Nations releasing a report on what's happening.
Yeah, and you know, it was sort of a coordinated response. And what I sort of took away from reading all the stories about it was that the State Department was saying, you know, we need to have a coordinated effort. We need to deal with the sanctions issues. It feels like it took a whole lot longer than it took with Libya. And maybe the impetus, and it's unclear why it took that long, but it looks like the impetus was the UN report, that when, you know, the world body is chiming in and going, okay, look, it's really out of hand,
right,
then all of a sudden there was enough synergy to move the ball to the next place. But it's about to get moved. You feel it. Like, it's about to get moved. When it got moved in Libya, it meant, you know, U.S. forces.
Right.
So you sort of feel like here it is, as you say, it's the dog days of August, and it's about to get moved.
Deborah Roth, story number three in the countdown is from the New York Times. Stephen Lee Myers, a story on the United States and allies calling for a Syria's President Bashar al-Assad to step down. You can find that linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. David Olive, your story number three is another shot from the outside, for the Beltway crowd, at Washington, D.C. newest Republican presidential candidate, Rick Perry, wanting to make Washington irrelevant was the word.
Inconsequential.
Inconsequential was the word. That's pretty strong stuff for somebody
also,
who wants to be.
It's also amazing that a governor of Texas could actually use a word that has more than two syllables.
Nah.
So,
this political statement brought to you by David Olive.
No, I think the real thing that is fascinating to me about this story and why it's my number three story of the week over many others that we could have picked. And this is not the dog days of summer, although it may be the cat days of summer, is that Rick Perry was not in this race a week ago today. He didn't even announce until last Saturday, the same day that Michelle Bachmann won a straw poll in Iowa and was perceived to be kind of the front runner, and how quickly the news dropped off of what she said. And so here is Perry in the very first week, shooting from the lip is what I called it.
Uh-huh.
And he criticizes Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve and infers that he has committed treason, and then suggests that his whole purpose for a campaign is to make Washington inconsequential. At the very same time he said that, the State Department comes back and says, be very careful what you say and how this is perceived overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And so my story, I think, fits with the one that Deborah had, because here the White House was trying to build an international consensus and say, rather than going out ahead of everybody, we want to come together as a group, but we are not irrelevant. We are leading, whether from the front or from behind, I think is a political question that will be debated over the months.
Mm-hmm.
But we are putting these things together. We are not inconsequential. And now the number one candidate of the Republicans, at least in terms of media coverage, is attacking Washington in ways that may have unintended consequences, in addition to the attacking the federal workplace and all the things that the federal government stands for. I thought that was a sea change, and I bet Governor Perry is not quite so quick with the quip during the next week that he's in this race.
The part of this that I thought was the most interesting, Dave, is the fact that right now within the United States, the percentage of people that are paying attention to the presidential race I wonder if it's possible to be less than zero. I mean, almost nobody is really paying attention to what people like Rick Perry is saying.
And that makes this year no different than 4 years ago.
Exactly. But people outside the United States, in capitals around the world, who are interested in where we might be leadership-wise a year and a half from now, are tremendously interested in the presidential race and what people like him are saying. And so it seems to me that if you're Rick Perry, you should be considering the fact that you're speaking more to David Cameron and Nicolas Sarkozy than you're speaking to Mr. and Mrs. Voter in Iowa or New Hampshire.
The problem with that is that the Camerons and Sarkozys and Merkels and others in our ally base don't vote in the primaries, and that's who you've got to persuade that you are the best candidate.
But I just wonder, even if the people who are voting are paying attention to stuff like this, unless somebody says something really off the mark like this.
Or they have an issue that is more close to them, an economic issue, a jobs issue, that will carry more weight than what this does. No different than where President Obama was 4 years ago. We're seeing his words now come back to haunt him, mm-hmm. about the federal deficit. You see it every 4 years.
Yeah.
It's not that uncommon, but it is unfortunate.
The number three story is chosen by David Olive on the Federal News Countdown this week is about Rick Perry and some of the comments he's making on the campaign trail, and it is linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, just like all of our stories. The number two story of the week is chosen by David Olive and Deborah Roth when In Depth with Francis Rose continues on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
To defend our nation effectively, missile defense must be affordable, available, and reliable. Lockheed Martin's team for ground-based mid-course defense is the right team to meet this challenge. Our proven performance-based logistics capabilities have been refined on more than 50 programs and honored by 9 Secretary of Defense awards. increasing confidence and readiness while reducing sustainment cost is all a question of how, and it is the how that Lockheed Martin delivers. For ground-based mid-course defense, the Lockheed Martin team has the know-how for success, the people, the processes, the performance. Together, we have built strong government-industry partnerships, led the industry in performance-based logistics, and built systems that have achieved more than 50 intercepts in test and combat, assuring affordability, availability, and reliability for ground-based mid-course defense is all a question of how, and it is the how that Lockheed Martin delivers.
Here's Dr. Ron Ross, Senior Computer Scientist and Information Security Researcher, NIST, on the Federal Executive Forum on Cybersecurity, sponsored by HP Enterprise Services.
That's where the real vision for the future kicks in. We've got to be able to have the systems and the infrastructure churn at a rate that even though the systems have been penetrated, the adversary's time on target is so limited that they can't do any damage.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Could your IT security have made you less secure? Traditional IT security defenses, firewalls, encryption, and intrusion detection systems are extremely effective. And that's the problem. They're so good that the bad guys are now training their sights on a new target: exploitable vulnerabilities in software applications. HP can help governments secure mission-critical applications by designing security in from the beginning, finding the vulnerabilities inside existing software, and fixing them quickly and cost-effectively. Learn more. Visit hp.com/go/cybersecurity.
Profile America, Friday, August 19th. It may still seem like summer. It's hot, and many people are on vacation. But one of the nation's largest seasonal events is already underway. It's back to school time. From nursery school to college, 77 million students are headed to the classroom. That's more than one out of four of the total of U.S. population age 3 and over. Of the 56 million elementary and high school students enrolled this fall, 11% will attend private schools. There are almost 99,000 public schools across the country, along with nearly 34,000 private schools. Getting ready for school this month means buying a lot of new clothes, nearly $7.5 billion worth. You can find these and more facts about America from the U.S. Census Bureau online at census.gov.
I'm Amy Morris. Here's a look at Monday morning's Federal Drive. The Government Printing Office and the Office of the Federal Register have come up with a new way to make sure government information is open and transparent. And how is Executive Order 13514 working out for your agency? We'll have an assessment of sustainability. That and more Monday morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. For all the latest federal news, check us out, federalnewsradio.com.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as chosen by Deborah Roth and David Olive. And we have a happy coincidence this week because we're up to
number two.
And the second most important story, as chosen by both of them, is by Emily Kopp on federalnewsradio.com. USPS puts cuts to labor on the bargaining table. Deborah, you have a lot of experience in personnel and employment issues in federal government. Have you ever seen a negotiation where the management says about a week before the negotiations start, we're going to cut about 25% of our workforce and let another 20% or so go by attrition? I probably have the numbers wrong. But that's essentially what happened here. The Postal Service said we're going to cut 125,000 employees and let another 100,000 go and through attrition, and their jobs won't be filled. And then a week later, sit down with their union and start to negotiate contracts. I don't recall anything like that happening.
Well, they have to negotiate the contracts because their contracts are up.
Sure.
But their management's in this really unique position of leverage because they're bankrupt. And so knock yourself out, union, come to the table, negotiate. There's no money.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, what are we negotiating? I read something I thought was very interesting. It was equated to being bankrupt. And if they were allowed to, quote unquote, go bankrupt, they would go through a bankruptcy proceeding and all those contracts would be subject to renegotiation
Just like what happened to the car companies a couple
of years
ago.
Yeah, well, it's subject to renegotiation through the bankruptcy proceeding.
Yeah.
And so their feeling is, you know, we're bankrupt, and, you know, we're going to treat this like a bankruptcy proceeding, and we're going to do these cuts. The other stat that came out in Emily Kopp's story was 80%, which, you know, I wonder about – I'm not saying it's wrong. 80% of the Postal Service's costs are in labor and benefits, not in running their facilities. Like – because a lot of, you know, a lot of what you hear about cutting the Postal Service is, you know, outside of metropolitan areas, it's where people, that's how people get their mail.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very expensive, you hear, to have these outposts and to have a service that can really get mail to 300 million people in all of the places that cover, you know, the United States. And it's not just the domestic United States. We know that covers, you know, the, you know, Guam and Hawaii. And so you always sort of hear like, oh, that's so expensive. And here's this stat, 80%. So it sort of sounds like if you've been following what goes on in the states with their budget cuts, you know, they have, they're saying, the people who are making the cuts, they're saying, forget partisanship, not, you know, forget where the partisan politics are. They're like, well, we can't afford these payrolls, mm-hmm, and these benefits, and it's the unfunded parts of it. And I saw something about the tens of billions of dollars in unfunded liabilities in health insurance and pension benefits for the Postal Service over the next 20 years. It's like, where will they get that money? There's no potential to get, you know, to raise additional revenue through first-class mail.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it's the opposite, Deborah. It's the Postal Pension Fund that is overfunded.
That's what they say.
And the congressional mandate is, and Congress has not changed it, although they have been asked to do so over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. There are inspector general reports, there are GAO reports, there are congressional reports that say this pension fund is overfunded. If we could take the money that we are having to overfund this with and apply it back to operations, then we have a better opportunity to keep people on. But Congress has not let them do that yet. Therefore, the Deputy Postmaster General just 2 days ago came out and said, if we have to make the next pension payment per the law, then we will be bankrupt.
Yeah, it'll put them over the debt ceiling.
Yeah.
But I saw sort of the stats on that they think they're overpaying into the system, and it is by billions. There's no doubt it's by billions. But when you look at the amount of billions that they're in debt, and the projection of how the decrease in use of first-class mail will be over the next whatever number of years, it's not clear that even getting that money back out of the pension fund that they feel they've overpaid will really help them. It's not a quick fix. It's a short-term fix. And you sort of have to applaud the Postal Service that they're ready to go in and really, address this head-on. But it still envisions a postal service. When you start reading things outside the mainstream, they're talking about, like, do we really need it?
Save that thought. I want to come back to that. But because that's the big problem here, is this is a structural business model, cultural issue, as much or more than it is a business operations issue. Because the Postal Service saying they want to lay off 120,000 people. And yet, if you do a 5-year out projection for the way their trends are headed, that's not even nearly enough. You know, they're going to still be back at this same situation 2, 3, 5 years from now.
Yeah, let us remember and that the Postal Service Reorganization Act in the 70s set them up as an independent business. They do not get subsidies across the board. They are not part of the federal budget. This deficit does not contribute to the overall federal deficit that we talk about.
Right.
I think there's a large misunderstanding in the general public, at least, about that.
Mm-hmm.
But they're under a mandate going back now some 40 years to operate a break-even business or in a profitable mode. And so the Postal Board of Governors is required to take steps like this where the financial situation is as dire, mm-hmm, as it is. They can't raise their rates unless the Postal Rate Commission approves it, yet another bureaucratic hurdle they have to go through. So you do feel for the folks that are in a market where in the Spencer Johnson world, the cheese has moved and it keeps moving.
Yeah. Do you see parallels here, Dave, to what's going on in the overall budget situation, though? Because if 80% of their costs really are pay and benefits for employees, that's, to me, seems to be a similar parallel to the entitlements in the regular federal budget. I know they're not connected, but I wonder if there are parallels. And the Postal Service seems like they're finally recognizing that's where all the money is. We have to go after that, where we're not seeing that on Capitol Hill.
You know, I would tell you the exact same thing is true of a lot of government agencies, police organizations, fire departments, EMT organizations. The majority of their expenses are on employee pay and benefits. That doesn't make the Postal Service unique.
And that's why I picked it as my number two, because it is foretelling of things to come. And I think that it, you know, it's sort of when it's so dire, their circumstances are so dire, and the business model, Francis, you talked about, which is it's just it can't work. They don't move enough first-class mail. And the projections, I think the statistic I read was, from 2006 to present, there was a 25% decrease in first-class mail being sent through the system. That's how much, you know, went through the Internet, people paying their bills
and
things like that.
Sure, but on the other hand, their cargo and package stuff is going up. Their one-size ship. You know, if it fits, it ships campaign has caught on quite well. If there is a parallel, I think the better parallel for the inside Washington crowd would be what the Speaker and the minority leader in the House did a little over a week ago in terminating the PAGE program. Pages were originally set up and brought to Washington to be couriers to deliver papers between offices. And the Speaker and Ms. Pelosi have now determined that with electronic communications, that this is an institution whose time has come and gone, even though it is part of the history and fabric of Capitol Hill.
Well, that's one of the things that you talked about, Debbie, before we went on the air. So let's explore that a little bit when we come back from the break. The number two story of the week on the Federal News Countdown, coincidentally chosen by both Deborah Roth and David Olive, is Emily Kopp's story on federalnewsradio.com. USPS puts cuts to labor on the bargaining table, and we'll discuss it some more when we come back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The Government IT Solutions Spotlight is brought to you by CDWG.
NASA awarded the final of four contracts to revamp its IT infrastructure. Under the Information Technology Infrastructure Integration Program, known as I3P, NASA awarded four technology contracts over the past year that could be worth more than $4 billion. In the latest deal, the space agency hired the Portal Group Consulting. The company will install and operate hardware and software and provide support services for NASA headquarters in Washington. The five-year contract is worth $82 million.
If you're in federal IT, you know that every internet connection and every mobile device poses a threat to your data. Visit cdwg.com/security to learn how our security experts use the latest technology to help keep your agency ahead of those threats. CDWG. People who get it.
Visit CDWG.com to learn how SonicWall VPN technologies can allow your agency to securely transmit data without the risk of being corrupted or hijacked.
The Pentagon and Beyond is brought to you by EADS North America.
Radical cleric Muqtada al-Sadr wants the U.S. out of Iraq. He restated that demand again yesterday. But General David Petraeus said on the Pentagon Channel,
"We've got to work with our Iraqi partners there to ensure that we can continue to provide for them various assistance capabilities and so forth that have proven to be very important for them, even as we do obviously continue to reduce our forces."
Al-Sadr says he wants anything that's American out. I'm G.G. Green.
We have a capsized boat, two people in the water.
Every day, EADS North America builds and supports helicopters for the Coast Guard, Army, National Guard, Navy, and Customs and Border Protection.
Rescue swimmer is in the water.
EADS delivers helicopters that save lives every day, including those bright orange Coast Guard helicopters you see patrolling our nation's capital.
We got them. We're heading back.
EADS North America. Commitment defines us.
Cloud computing. Your data and apps must move easily and securely to reach many clouds, not just one. That's why the network that connects, protects, and lets your data move fearlessly through the clouds means more than ever. See how. Cloud Advantage for Government. The Fed Cloud blog on federalnewsradio.com. Brought to you by Cisco and Intel.
The valuable information you get on the radio waves transmitted by Federal News Radio may one day provide an added benefit, power for some of your electrical devices. We're bathed in communication signals from radio, TV, and cell phones. Josh Smith, an Intel engineer, says we can tap those airwaves for energy.
The lowest power devices nowadays consume such a small amount of energy that you can actually power them off these signals that used to seem like they only had information.
Engineers are tuning antennas to pull in stray radio waves that are then converted into electricity.
It's starting to become possible to get rid of batteries from the lowest end devices.
Smith has already demonstrated it works to power a kitchen thermometer and has other applications like clocks and mobile phones in mind. To find out more, go to www.nae.edu/radio. That's nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
If I could have a heart-to-heart with my dad.
If I could have a heart-to-heart with my mom.
I'd probably talk about girls.
We'd probably talk about girls.
Anything, boys, school, clothes.
You'd be amazed at what they'll talk about if you give them the chance.
If I had a heart-to-heart with my dad.
If it were a real heart-to-heart, I'd tell my parents what I'm going through.
I'd probably talk to them about growing up.
I'd probably tell my dad that I wish we'd do more stuff together.
I don't think it has to be a heart-to-heart. I just want to talk.
Give your family everything. Give them your time. From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
We're back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Story number two on the Federal News Countdown, as selected by my experts on the panel this week, Deborah Roth of Shaw, Bransford & Roth, and David Olive of Catalyst Partners, is Emily Kopp's story on federalnewsradio.com about the Postal Service getting ready to negotiate with some of its biggest unions. And this whole situation with the Postal Service has generated all kinds of conversations around the country about what the Postal Service should look like in the future. The former Postmaster General John Potter used to regularly cite postal services in other countries that perform banking services, and they sell wireless telephone services and all kinds of things. Our Postal Service has tried any number of different retail activities that you would go to the post office and you'd see different kinds of. They sold phone cards for a while and all kinds of things. None of those seem to stick. And so folks are really starting to think. Debbie, you sent in addition to Emily's article, you sent in a piece that you saw on Slate about the whole conversation of the relevance of the Postal Service at all in this day and age, and what maybe even more dramatic reformations and reshaping are necessary than anything anybody's talked about so far.
You know, during the break, we had a small conversation, and it sort of gave me
a different... But it was loud.
It gave me a different angle, so I'm now prepared to have a different angle. I think for the average American, you know, when we come home every day to our mailbox, the Postal Service is beginning to feel irrelevant. It's certainly hard to argue the need, like you shall deliver mail 6 days a week. How many of us can truly say that we need mail delivery 6 days a week? We can't function without it. And of course, I was complaining about the junk mail, and that is the Postal Service really in business today to move junk mail? And so much of what you do as a private citizen, you know, couldn't you just do that online, making the whole concept of the Postal Service irrelevant? Although David makes a good point, I'm going to let him do it all, which is when I think about eliminating the mail service from my business, all of a sudden now, I'm not in the least bit interested in eliminating the Postal Service.
Right.
I'm not at all. Now I get it, and there is a commercial. I mean, it is a capitalistic economy, and there is a commercial need for what the Postal Service does. Getting it right seems to be a historic problem.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, but I see this in other institutions where you're delivering information. Do we really need, and I can say this in a radio station, Francis, newspapers? what has happened to newspaper circulation? What has happened to the daily delivery and the carbon footprint of printing and the gathering of the papers that are left on the trains and all the things where people are trying to get information? In your practice, do you really need law books anymore?
No.
Why can't you get them
online? It's all
online.
Mm-hmm. And I have a friend in the newspaper industry who says that where we are in our generation, our contemporaries, you know, around the 40 and 50-year-olds, we are the last readers of a daily piece of paper.
Yeah.
Well, that's what the newspaper industry is predicting.
Warren Buffett said not too long ago, if we had the electronic infrastructure that we have now, and somebody came along and said, you know what, to deliver information, I'm going to build a huge warehouse and put a bunch of printing presses in, and then we'll have rolls of paper brought in, and we'll print the news on that, and then we'll hire people to go around in trucks and put them in little boxes and lay them on people's front porches. Nobody would support that. People would think that was just completely nuts. And yet that's the transition mode that we find ourselves in
and
when
yet,
it comes to all of this stuff.
And yet there is still a role for the Postal Service.
Mm-hmm.
There is a confidence that we have that our financial records will not be hacked or stolen or identity stolen, where we have a delivery from a postal worker, or whether we go pick it up at a post office box, or how we do that.
So there's enormous confidence in the integrity of the delivery service.
We have looked at what has happened in the printed book industry, and yet there are still people that are old geezers like me that love the tactile feel and the ability to turn pages, whether that changes with the new netbooks or tablets or whatever the next generation technology is. We're adapting. And part of the problem the Postal Service has is the work rules they have and the structure they're in has not allowed them to adapt as quickly as the technology and the culture has changed. And I think we're going to see that play out in these negotiations and going forward.
You're not an old geezer. You're one of the youngest geezers that I know. So so you're wrong there.
Geezer, just not old.
They're just half right.
We're almost out of time, but just a quick yes or no from each of you. Does this indication what the Postal Service is doing give you confidence that they're trying to adapt, as David's talking about, Debbie?
Yeah. Yes. The question is, will the unions hear them loud and clear, or will they suffer the same fate that's happening in the states?
Or will the union adapt and do them one step better and allow them to become more efficient and therefore preserve the jobs, which are at the heart of what the union wants to do? That's the open question.
Story number two on the Federal News Countdown this week from Deborah Roth and from David Olive is Emily Kopp's story on federalnewsradio.com. USPS puts cuts to labor on the bargaining table. We're up to story number one for each of the guests on the Federal News Countdown this week, and we'll talk about those in moments on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The men and women of our National Guard and Reserve Forces are working hard on the battlefield and here at home. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve is working just as hard for them. For over 36 years, ESGR has paved the way for greater understanding between our Guard and Reserve Forces and their civilian employers, promoting a culture where all American employers support and honor the military service of their employees. Together, we all serve. To learn more, visit www.esgr.mil.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
The FBI has released its first ever mobile application. It's designed to help locate missing children. The FBI Child ID app lets parents store photos and vital information about their kids, so it's immediately available to pass on to authorities in the event a child goes missing. It also lets parents email photos directly to law enforcement. And it includes tips on what to do in the first hours after a child disappears. The iPhone version is out now. The FBI says other devices will be supported soon.
General Dynamics Information Technology is dedicated to providing the latest, highest quality information technology services and resources to help organizations meet their mission objectives. Large-scale IT systems and communications networks are the strategic and operational heart of defense, intelligence, civilian government, and private business. They require the expertise of a company that delivers results. General Dynamics Information Technology. Information technology and professional services. Go to GDIT.com to learn more. That's GDIT.com. Newsmakers, talk to Jason Miller on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Beth McGrath, DOD's Deputy Chief Management Officer.
Secretary Hale and I, we're doing the evaluation piece, if you will, of the efficiencies. Once the efficiencies were identified and booked in the budget, we're doing the follow-through to say, well, you know, what's your plan to get there? And then we'll be tracking and monitoring those as we go through the 12 fiscal year.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive.
You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests on the Federal News Countdown this week are Deborah Roth from Shaw Bransford and Roth and David Olive of Catalyst Partners. And we are up to
number one.
The most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Deborah Roth and David Olive. And now you guys chose the same number two stories. You didn't choose exactly the same number one stories, but they're so connected that I think we should combine them and talk about them together. Debbie, your story number one is from GovExec. The headline is Agencies Turn to Buyouts in Tough Budget Environment. And Dave, your story is from Ruben Gomez and Jolie Lee here at federalnewsradio.com. OMB mandates 5% cut to 2013 budgets. It's not exactly the same story, but it's pretty much the same story. It really revolves on how agencies are going to deal with a number off the top line and how that's going to filter down to everything else, to every other item, line item in the budget. What do you...
And the message is, you know, you should leave now before we make you leave.
Mm-hmm.
And we know we're going to have to do it. So, and of course, federal employees in the agencies where they're being offered the VERA and the VSIP are, you know, sophisticated. And for those who are eligible, they know what it means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been practicing law for 22 years, and I think only twice in my career was part of the practice involving RIFs and furloughs. It happens so infrequently, and it happens in bad budgetary times. Now, VERA and VSIPs that are back on the table, the incentive pay and the early retirement option, the last time we saw it in bulk was in the, you know, 90s in the Clinton administration, and it was not for budgetary reasons. It was Al Gore's,
government.
It was his big push as a vice president was to make government. I forgot, you know, he's going to make government more efficient.
It was a management tool, not a budget tool.
Right. And that was his thing. And so, to get rid of, and it was not selective. I mean, that was the criticism. It was just offered in mass. There was no thought about where, which agencies, which work groups, which parts of the workforce. And so you see sort of you see that correction this time around. It's being offered to certain offices and agencies and certain types of employees, maybe agency wide. But, you know, they're getting ready. They know it's coming. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to have to deal with smaller budgets. What you don't know, I mean, I just don't know this anecdotally, is for every agency, what part of their budget really is,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's called S&E, you know, salary and expenses. What the part that you, part of the budget for the agency gets that just funds people coming to work. Like, you know, I don't have that anecdotally, but mm-hmm. they must know that they're going to have to tighten up that part because welcome to buyouts.
Yeah, yeah. Long term, as we look at what I went upstairs and talked about this on WTOP yesterday, and the question they asked me was, well, why aren't they talking about the fiscal 2012 budget? Because 2012 is not here yet. And I reminded them that for the federal government, in 6 weeks, 2012 is here. And we were talking about that a little bit during the break. We're getting into continuing resolution territory for 2012. So we're already planning for a year and a half, essentially, from now, if the continuing resolution thing works out the way that it was. When did we finally get budgets for 2011? Was it in February or March?
It was either late March or early April, because it was
It wasn't it February.
No,
they started
and it was 6 months.
Okay, so we're looking at like a year and a half from now before this stuff even comes to Congress, or before Congress will probably do something.
A 2013
about it.
Budget.
Yeah.
And Francis, many of the agencies, the Department of Defense being the leader, of course, put out a multi-year plan, because a lot of the procurements that they do require multi-year development, testing, evaluation before they can be deployed. The Appropriations Committee reports are replete with, give us your three-year, five-year spending plan.
Mm-hmm.
And the agencies look at them and go, why should we engage in this useless exercise? Because you're going to come back in and whack our budget or tell us what to do with it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that struck me as I read the series of stories, both about buyouts and others, is OMB wants to get ahead of where the Congressional Super Committee is and where the appropriators are, and they're handing a scalpel to the agencies and are saying, you're going to lose a foot. Either you cut it off or somebody else is. Which way do you want it to occur?
Mm-hmm.
And that strikes me that they're handing the knife to the agencies and say, you're better off doing it yourself than having somebody who doesn't know your agency and doesn't know the ins and outs of what you have and what you need and the specifics that Debbie was talking about, then giving it to folks on the Hill and letting them do as they will in a political environment.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, that is what congressional activity is all about, is advancing a political agenda, no matter which party.
Well, and of course, it gets the president into a, you know, not that this is a politics show, but it gets the president getting ready for the election. It gets him into a better position to be able to say, I want you to know what I've done to shrink, you know, the budgets of my government, and here's what we've already done on our own.
Of course, in previous years, this particular guidance had come out in the June, early June, late June timeframe. The fact that they're now putting it out in the middle of August is indicative of the uncertainty that came out of the budget discussions and the debt ceiling discussions over the past several months. So there will be a flurry of activity. That may be why we don't think we're in the dog days of summer, is that the activity on the debt debate pushed everything to the right.
Well, the reality is that the debt and the deficit are so enormous that it requires much long-term thinking. Mm-hmm. And that part, you know, all of the politics aside, that part, both branches of government have figured out, as have the American citizens. And I think federal employees are feeling it and they're seeing it at work. It's like, well, we definitely know long term this is not sustainable. And, you know, when you think of 5%, which is David's story, if we in our own households today were told, not today, but starting in January, you had to eliminate 5% from your household in expense, come on, we all could do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all could do it. The first to go would probably be cable TV for all of us, right? And the magazine subscription. But we all could do it. And, you know, I think that the president's the administration's trying to get ahead of what is the inevitable slashing coming from the Hill. And 5% sounds like, okay, well, that feels doable. And if you can't find 5%, then, you know, you're not being realistic.
I'll get somebody that can.
You know?
Sure. Yeah. But it is also, Francis, for the very first time in my memory, an actual 5% cut over the previous year. It's not a 5% cut in the rate of growth.
Yeah.
Which is the way they played the budget games in the past.
Yeah.
So this is a real cut.
It's the real thing.
They're not used to doing that.
Whether it is deep enough or not, I think, is going to be the political debate. But it is a definite change in trend. And the fact that OMB is trying to get out ahead of this, to me, made it the top story, because it's going to carry forward.
All right. David Olive's number one story is OMB mandates 5% cut to 2013 budgets. And Debbie Roth's number one story is the GovExec story, agencies turn to buyouts in tough budget times. Both of them budget-focused stories. And we'll wrap up our conversation on the Federal News Countdown this week in just one moment.
Government personnel must continue to achieve mission-critical objectives no matter their work environment. Video conferencing technologies provide a highly effective collaboration solution for federal employees affected by budget cuts, BRAC initiatives, and telework mandates if they are secure based on open standards and deployable in limited bandwidth environments.
Polycom is the first video provider to have an ultimate HD portfolio that is JITC certified, offering real-time face-to-face communication without compromising secure networks or consuming excessive bandwidth. Polycom enables government customers to collaborate over voice and video anywhere, anytime, securely both inside and outside the firewall, offering high-definition video calls at half the bandwidth of other companies. To learn more, visit polycom.com/federal.
The Telework Center arms you with all the information you need to know about teleworking in the federal government. Go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Polycom.
Given the current state of the economy and decreasing federal budgets, there is increasing pressure to achieve efficiencies across the enterprise while delivering the highest quality services to customers and stakeholders. In a time of cutting back, how do organizations keep their IT systems and networks ahead of the negative actors? CIOs grapple daily with an array of complex issues of their investments, and at the same time, CISOs are trying to prevent attacks while fending off existing threats. Booz Allen Hamilton believes federal agencies can meet the recent IT management requirements by optimizing their spending through investment in the right solutions. Listen to Cost-Effective IT in the Age of Mounting Cyber Threats as part of the Booz Allen Hamilton Expert Voices panel series featuring IT experts from across industry and government, Tuesday, August 23rd at 12 noon on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. For more information, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Booz Allen, or visit the Expert Voices blog at boozallen.com/expertvoices.
There are those who dedicate themselves to a sense of honor, to a life of courage, and a commitment to something greater than themselves. They have always defended this nation and each other. They still do. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Join Alan Greenspan, the former chair of the Federal Reserve System, as he discusses the intersection of economics and IT at the Innovation Nation Forum, August 23rd at the D.C. Convention Center. Also there, the Merit Awards will recognize the best idea to use IT to improve government with a $50,000 cash prize. Shake IT up. Register at meritalk.com. That's MERITALK.com.
Back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the Federal News Countdown. With David Olive and Deborah Roth, and the number one stories this week are both linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and they are both about the budget. Different stories, but same idea. And my crack producer, Emily Jarvis, reminds me that the government passed the budget for fiscal 2011 on April 8th of this year. So we were all wrong, and we were all early. So it was even later than we were talking about. So kudos to Emily for that fact, for taking care of us on that. This whole concept is, I've heard it described a number of different ways. The way I hear the most often, though, is the new normal. Do you each get a sense that people in Congress, that people at the agencies understand that and buy into that, or do people, are there still some people who think it's just a blip on the radar screen and in a year or two we'll be back to the way we've always done things?
Yeah, no blip on the radar screen. I think it has set in. Let's talk about the rank and file federal employee. You know, you have like 1.92 million federal employees. Maybe it's at 2.1.
Mm-hmm.
So for, you know, people who are not in managerial positions or close to policymakers, I think maybe a year ago it felt like, oh, it'll pass. Maybe the rhetoric will pass. We won't get our raises for this year, but things will improve. I think that the reality of the economy and the reaction of the markets and worldwide to the whole debt ceiling thing, I think that everybody feels this is for real and it's going to last. If you're in a position of policymaking or you're close to policymakers, you know this one's going to last a long time. Mm-hmm. It has to.
Yeah.
My sense is the Hill has grasped this much quicker than the executive branch. It is definitely a sea change on the Hill. You can feel it when you walk down the hallway. I don't get that same feeling when I'm walking through an executive branch agency, but they know that something is very different. They don't quite know how to deal with it because they're getting a lot of mixed signals. And they know the need is still there for what they deliver.
Right.
They just don't understand why people don't see that.
What do you think would clear up those mixed signals to the agencies and give them the clarity that they don't have right now?
The most immediate thing that could occur would be for Congress to give them a budget where they can plan for a full year instead of being at the end of a yo-yo where they're up and down every couple of weeks or every couple of months.
And the odds of that happening are, do you think?
Less than 5%.
Uh-huh. That's
for a 2012 budget.
For 2012, yeah. And maybe even 2013 because of the presidential election year, the fact that there'll be a change in Congress and the ability to get things done. I can't find a single congressional race across the country where a candidate is running for office saying, I want to go to Washington to compromise and make government work more efficiently. And I hope that somebody out there among the five listeners you were talking about earlier will send me a note and say, oh, no, here's an example of where it occurs.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd said that I was on your show months ago and I said, you know, or maybe it was last year when they started talking about the pay freeze and there was all this noise in the federal community. And I was, you know, like, well, aren't they a little they're sort of last to the table? The executive branch seemed to be last to the table in realizing it was 2 years mm-hmm. after the crash and most of Americans lost their jobs. It seems that the executive branch has been extremely slow in appreciating the turmoil that this government and economy is in. And I'm going to refine my response a bit based upon what David said, which is I think that the executive branch is clear that workers, the actual employees, are sort of in a fog and they see that this is real and going to last a long time, but I think they're still slightly dazed and confused. Whereas on the Hill, it's very clear.
A terrific conversation. That's where we have to leave it on the Federal News Countdown this week. Okay, say something then. David Olive just holding his arms out.
The anniversary of 9/11 is coming up.
Yes.
I would say that my honorable mention story is mm-hmm. the story about the documentary with Richard Clark talking about whether there was a cover-up by the CIA with the people that were terrorists. Stay tuned. That one is going to be a big story within the next 2 weeks.
Why do you think so? Just because of the 9/11?
Because the anniversary of 9/11. It's the first time it's come out in 10 years. It was made by Richard Clark, the former National Security Advisor in the White House, against George Tenet, the head of the CIA at the time. It has red flags written all over it from every different angle, so stay tuned.
And you heard about it here first from David Olive. Thank you very much for being on the program. Deborah Roth, great to see you as
Thank
always.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Always fun.
It is, indeed. The stories that they've chosen on the countdown are posted at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Coming up in a few minutes on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, we talked about the budget cuts that OMB is asking your agency to make. Some expert analysis from a former deputy director at that agency on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.